From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with political aide turned columnist Christopher Matthews. He draws from his years as a political insider in his new book, Hardball, How Politics is Played. Also today, I speak with writer Parvati Mukherjee. Her new book of short stories examines the clash of cultures when immigrants try to maintain their cultural identity in America. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from trombonist Earl Turbinton. And CBS is rerunning its crime series, Wise Guy. TV critic David Bianculli has a recap. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Christopher Matthews says he learned the rules to the game of political power by working for powerful people. He served as an aide to Senator Frank Moss of Utah, was a speechwriter for President Carter, and for 6 years was the top assistant to Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill. Matthews' new book, Hardball, How Politics is Played, is about the political lore that is passed on from one generation to the next on how to get and keep political power. As for Matthews, for now he's given up on playing the game to observe and report on it. He's currently the Washington bureau chief of the San Francisco Examiner and a syndicated columnist. I spoke with Matthews from station WAMU in Washington, D.C. Now, first, I wanted him to analyze a political speech. So to get a kind of standard political speech, I chose one by Jack Tanner, the fictitious presidential candidate played by Michael Murphy in HBO's continuing satire Tanner 88. The series is written by Gary Trudeau, the creator of the political cartoon strip Doonesbury. I chose this episode of Tanner because it features Matthews in a cameo as one of the influential people invited to a party for Tanner. So here we go. This is Tanner on ecology.
What's happened in the last 8 years is tragic. There was no need to declare war on the environment or on environmentalists. The most recent Gallup and Harris polls show strong public opinion on this issue. People want the environment protected. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. It means clean air. It means clean water. And it means a government which makes it its business to see that the public interests are protected.
All right. All right.
American people choose me as their leader, I will recommit this nation to a course of bipartisan progressive environmentalism, and I intend to leave a legacy of which our children can be proud. As president, I will swear faithfully to uphold the laws of the United States, and I will see to it that the people who pollute with impunity are prosecuted to the full extent of the law. As Adlai Stevenson said in 1965, we are all travelers on spaceship Earth.
Okay, Christopher Matthews, you've written a lot of speeches in your time. How would you rate that one?
Well, it was filled with applause lines, all aimed at the same crowd, what Tip O'Neill used to call the Save the Whales crowd. Basically, if you were doing it with Val's sort of a marketer's analysis, you would say he was going after the Volvo Democrat.
I love his quote at the end about Adlai Stevenson saying "Spaceship Earth."
Yeah, I sort of recall about Jerry Brown in that direction at one point.
Oh dear!
But I think it was an attempt to fight a straw man. It was an attempt to try to rally a group of activists to the threat that they're being overrun. When in fact environmentalism is still pretty popular, they're not beset by all kinds of forces right now. Most people are pretty environmental these days. The example is George Bush has just done a flip flop on offshore oil in California.
Well, let me ask you. You said that there were a lot of applause lines in that speech,
right?
But most of the applause lines said absolutely nothing. Like, I stand for bipartisan progressive environmentalism. Like, what does that mean?
That means he's addressing a group of environmentalists, and that they like to hear that. I mean, most people don't hear applause lines. They hear the punch. They hear they hear the word they want to hear. They were there for that reason. Although I think that was satirical. I don't think.
Of course.
I don't think anybody would. I mean, I watched that when.
No,
it was,
but people do, don't you think? I mean, haven't you heard speeches like that that were as like, what did he say? As this speech is.
Well, I think that's true, but that's pretty free of content. That one.
Okay. Now, you were a speechwriter for many years. You wrote a lot of speeches for Jimmy Carter.
That's right.
Did you ever write say-nothing speeches? Speeches with applause lines that didn't have anything to say?
Well, that wouldn't work because you're constantly trying to... Well, I guess one thing you're trying to do, though, is you're trying to write that magic 10-second bite which will make the network news. And so you're trying to find a way of saying something so incisive, so compellingly, that it comes down to maybe 10 words or 20 words. So in a sense, you're not saying a lot of detail or definition, but you're really trying to punch it so that it makes your point.
Let's get to the current real campaign and leave Jack Tanner behind.
I'm waiting to see whether Jack Tanner runs in the general. Is he going to run third party? How are they going to keep that thing alive?
I don't know. I guess we'll find out. Let me just reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. My guest is Christopher Matthews, who's currently Washington Bureau Chief for the San Francisco Examiner, a syndicated columnist and author of the new book Hardball, How Politics is Played. Now, it seems to me, watching this current campaign, that people are no longer talking about platforms. They're talking about themes. Like, what is the theme of the Dukakis campaign, or what is the theme of the Bush campaign? What's the difference between a theme and platforms, and why are we talking about themes?
Well, I think that's probably the case that there isn't a big, tremendous debate going on about ideology this year. I think Dukakis has brilliantly positioned himself as a centrist slash ethnic candidate. In other words, he's used Jackson very effectively to establish the fact that Jackson's on the left, Mike Dukakis is in the middle, George Bush is on the right. And everyone wants to get in the middle, and Jackson has allowed Dukakis to get to the middle. Just imagine if Jackson had quit this race 2 months ago. Dukakis would be the liberal-to-left candidate. He's now seen as the centrist candidate. So Michael Dukakis is establishing his position ideologically by saying no to gay activists, saying no to Jackson on a couple of issues like taxes, and it's pretty smart politics.
Now, your book is about Hardball, how to play power politics. How would you evaluate how Bush and Dukakis play that game compared to each other?
Well, Dukakis is much more formidable because no matter what you ask Michael Dukakis, he will turn the issue against George Bush. If you ask him about his lack of a foreign policy resume, which is a very good question, he will say, well, the man with the longest resume in foreign policy sat by while they sold arms to Iran. If you ask him about the Sandinistas, he'll say the biggest threat to our country is not the Sandinistas, but the threat of drugs into our own neighborhoods. If you ask him about capital punishment, for drug czars or drug kingpins, he will say that's hypocritical when our own administration is doing business with General Noriega. So he always cleverly spins the issue off into the direction of his opponent. And it doesn't seem nasty, but it's very effective. I don't think George Bush is anywhere near this level of sophisticated.
Okay.
George Bush, is, I think, as far as I can tell, has like one thing going for him, or maybe two things. One is he's personally honest. I think that will show. I think that's why he's taking on Jim Wright in this affair this week, because I think he feels that's an area of strength. He is one man who has gotten poorer while he's been in public life, I think. The second thing he's got going for him is that the economy is pretty good, actually. It's even picking up in the Midwest right now, and its consumer confidence is high. So it's possible that if he continues to marry Ronald Reagan and take credit for what's happening economically, that he might be able to squeak a victory out in November. But I'd bet on Dukakis because of the superior political talent of the man.
When you left politics, you first headed up an organization that was basically a political consulting group.
And yes, now, we did. We did kind of heavy-duty intellectual research, although I wasn't known as the heavy-duty intellectual researcher. I was basically trying to build the company up.
Okay, now you're in journalism.
Right.
And you've written your first book. You've left politics. You've written a book about politics. You have not written a kiss-and-tell book about your days working for Jimmy Carter or Tip O'Neill. This is a book about how power politics is played. Now, I think the fact that you have not written a kiss-and-tell book illustrates one of the principles of your book, which is loyalty is everything in this business.
Right. Well, I'll dance with the one that brung you is the phrase. And I think it's not just a question of morality. It's a question of reputation. I mean, Don Regan's at the end of the line career-wise. I guess he can take his chances and play the game he played in humiliating Mrs. Reagan. I don't know why a person would want to establish the fact that they were disloyal. because I think even if you change teams or change careers, you should retain some kind of loyalty to what you did before. I think Gene McCarthy, one of my old heroes, once said this of Richard Goodwin. He said he's the kind of fellow that can change uniforms without giving away the signals. And I think that in a modern society where people change positions all the time, I think it makes you look very bad when you rat on people you worked for before.
Well, you've betrayed, however, one of the themes from your book, which is think of the press as the enemy. You've become the press.
No, I think that's advice to people who are not in the press. When you deal with the press, always remember that they have a totally different nervous system than you have. And they are the enemy in the sense that never say anything to a reporter that you don't expect to be taken down and used against you. And that's accurate. And I don't think I'm betraying that. I think any reporter you sat down with and had a drink with would tell you that reporters cannot be trusted to keep confidences because that's not their job. Their job is to report the facts, particularly the facts that are sensitive. And so I think people, I always watch 60 Minutes, and I always wonder how they get these guys to come clean. And what I think they do is they spend 3 or 4 hours running tape, and then after 3 or 4 hours of getting to know each other on a firsthand basis, they come through with the zinger. And I think it's done very cleverly, and I don't think people are stupid that get drawn into it, but I think people have to be made especially aware that whatever they say could easily appear on the front page of the newspaper the next day.
There has been something of a revolving door between politics and the press. Why did you walk through that door?
Well, I guess it's a fact that I've always wanted to speak my mind, and writing speeches for someone else allowed me to do it to some extent, but clearly being a columnist and a commentator is just about 100% freedom. I have the ability to shoot in any direction I want to. If I feel that someone's wrong on the Democratic side or the Republican side, I have practically no constraints in saying what I think is true. In fact, I don't think I have any.
Let's talk about
Whereas when you work for a politician, you are in fact a lieutenant. No matter how grand your position may be, I don't think anyone is under the illusion that the boss doesn't call the shots.
Okay, let's talk about some of the gaffes that you made as an aide when you were in politics. You learned nothing is off the record the hard way.
I sure did.
You want to describe?
One of the things, I think, one time I was allowed a reporter who was, I think, British educated to do a profile about me. And his editor added an introductory paragraph that said, "Everyone in Washington who is anyone knows how Chris Matthews guides the Speaker of the House." Now, I actually had no control over that, but I lived to regret it because it suggested that I was the boss in a relationship where I was clearly not the boss. And I think that's the kind of thing you have to be very careful with the press. Every time you risk public attention, every time you put yourself in the limelight, you run the risk, for better or worse, of getting nailed.
What did Tip O'Neill say when he saw that in print, that you guide him?
He corrected that. He told me that he guided me. Mm-hmm. And he also used rather colorful language in describing his relative superiority to me in political acumen.
Any other gaffes?
In other words, he made it clear that he knew more about politics than I did, and I had just proven it. It was tough, but, you know, he didn't fire me, and it was wonderful for him not to, because some politicians would take that, and they wouldn't care how it happened. They just didn't want it to happen again. They wouldn't want it to happen again. So it's part of living life and dealing in a tough relationship. But anybody who thinks dealing with a man as strong as Tip O'Neill is easy isn't using their imagination. Just imagine you're dealing with a guy who fought his way to the top, 50 years of winning elections. He didn't do that by being a powder puff.
Let's talk about some of the stuff you had to deflect after it was printed in the media about Tip O'Neill. Was there an experience that you had where you had to take something negative about him that was printed and put a different spin on it?
Well, let me think. Nothing comes to mind except that we were always playing offense. We rarely got stuck in doing defense. The Democrats in the mid-80s, when they were fighting Reagan, tried to keep the emphasis on issues where Democrats win, which is called playing your strength. And I think the Democrats are very effective at arguing Social Security, arguing unemployment, recession, hitting the issues where the president was vulnerable. I think Reagan kept going back and accusing the speaker of being a tax and spender, a big spender, an old line liberal, which is accurate. And the way we deflected it was by keeping the focus on President Reagan. And the speaker came up with the notion of keeping the focus on the issue of fairness. fairness became a buzzword during the recession of 1981 and 82 for the failure of the what was seen to be the upper crusty administration to look out for the average person whose job was in danger. And so it was clearly an aggressive campaign. I don't think it was a defensive campaign.
Was there ever a time when a story broke and both the Reagan people and the Tip O'Neill people tried to put their own spin on it, and you were both working the press in your own ways for the same story? Maybe you could give us an example about how you both handled differently.
Well, let me give you some success stories of the Reagan administration, because I'm a big fan of their technique. Not that I agreed with their policies, but as technicians, they're the best. Especially the era when President Reagan was being assisted by Jim Baker and Mike Deaver together. They were geniuses when it came to public relations, even though Michael Deaver has not handled his own affairs very effectively. One of the cases that I thought was a dynamite piece of public relations was when David Stockman came public with the disclosure that the Reagan administration's entire economic program, A, didn't add up, the numbers were cooked, and B, it was all skewed towards helping the rich, even though the president had claimed he was out to help the average person. Well, that was a tremendous disaster, public relations-wise, and I thought the way they handled it was first rate in terms of just good old hardball. What they did was they took a story of revelation, which they couldn't handle because David Stockman refused to deny it. He refused to say what he had told the reporter was untrue. And so they had to switch the story or spin the story to a matter of betrayal. And so they cooked up this idea of a presidential trip to the woodshed where the president would take David Stockman into the woodshed and ceremoniously flay away at him to punish him for his betrayal. So what they did is they had a luncheon meeting at the White House, and it was heavily ballyhooed. And then out of the meeting came David Stockman, well choreographed to look miserable and despondent and humiliated. And they played this whole thing out. And by the evening news that night, they had put the story behind them. It was simply a story of David Stockman betraying the stern but fair Judge Hardy, the good old president, who, even though this young man had betrayed him, was a good enough father figure to keep him on the job. But 2 days later, the story was dead because it was just a People magazine human interest story of betrayal and expiation. And I think that could have easily been a profoundly important story of administration mismanagement, of a failed or a misconceived fiscal program, of a terribly socially unfair effort to give the upper-income people a great tax break at the expense of the rest of the country. If you want to talk hardball, that was probably the classiest piece of pure political footwork I've ever seen this administration pull off.
Okay, so you were applauding the Reagan administration for taking this this story about how Stockman knew certain things about Reaganomics wasn't going to work. And instead of it becoming an economic story, it became a story about loyalty, that
right.
Stockman wasn't loyal.
That's spin, right?
Yeah,
that's right.
Taking a problem and putting your own interpretation onto it.
Right.
Now, say you were in the press then, as you are now, what would you have done to counteract the spin that the Reagan administration was putting on the story?
Well, I think you'd have to get back to what was really being revealed and sit down and read the Atlantic Magazine article and try to get David Stockman on the record or to admit that what he said was true, and or at least get him in a position where he refused to deny it. I think I could have done that if I were writing for a major newspaper and wrote that story. I'm not sure it would have been able to overcome the powerful imagery that was cooked up by Jim Baker and Mike Deaver. I think the TV coverage would have so dominated the print coverage that it would have been very hard to stop that spin, because usually the print story, first of all, it comes the following day. You don't even get the paper till the next day. You get the evening news right away. And intellectually, it's easier for the average consumer of news to buy the People magazine story, the human interest angle. All I can say is I would try to bring the issue back to where it began. And one thing I think I would do that the White House press corps does not do, which I think is a bad statement about them, they tend to listen to White House aides on background, especially on mood matters. I don't know how many times I've turned on the evening news and watched one of these great, highly paid, highly appreciated journalists say, White House aides are upbeat tonight. White House aides are happy with the president's performance. White House aides believe they've got this problem behind them. Well, let me just tell you this, as having been a professional and to some extent a spin controller, that whatever the press is told by the White House media handlers, they're being told what is in the interest of the president to have them told. The spin that is being applied to them in terms of mood, in terms of atmospherics, is entirely fabricated. There's no such thing as a spontaneous mood in the White House. Those reporters are stuck in boxes and little cubicles. They're allowed to come out or talk to people on the phone only under the control of the White House staff. And so if they see a person smiling and giggling or in a good mood, they're intended to see that kind of performance. And it is a performance.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what.
So let me just tell you this. I was working for Jimmy Carter once, and he was giving a speech on the road. And it was right near the end of the 1980 campaign, and he was losing and not doing well. And I heard him say something that really upset me. So I frowned. And immediately one of the senior aides came over to me and said, "Don't do that." And you know what else? A New York Times reporter, a friend of mine, came over and said, "What's the matter, Chris?" Now, the game is to be, have your cheeks in a smiling position, almost like a thought control process, to create the notion that everything's going just swimmingly. And that is, in fact, the real spin that goes on in the White House press room every night of the week.
Look confident.
Well, that's right. And this thing about, I think the best thing for any news consumer is to make sure whenever they watch the news, they don't listen to any atmospherics reports.
Okay.
Don't say the mood is upbeat, none of that nonsense.
Okay, we're going to have to take a short break. What we'll do is we'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is Christopher Matthews. He's the Washington bureau chief for the San Francisco Examiner and writes a syndicated column. He previously worked as a speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter and was the chief spokesman for Tip O'Neill. His new book is titled Hardball: How Politics is Played. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Christopher Matthews is my guest, author of the new book, Hardball: How Politics is Played. You say something in your book, and I couldn't tell whether you meant this literally or not, that when you'd have your morning meeting with Tip O'Neill and he'd say, "What do you know?" he'd run a vacuum cleaner in the background so no one could overhear. Did I misinterpret that?
No, I said that he was like a vacuum cleaner because he would so totally empty out your head. He would sit there and make you, he would say, "I can't believe you misread that."
This is how paranoid
Stop
I am,
Stop speed reading.
Right?
Stop speed reading. Read every word next time. What I said was he was like a consumer of everything that you had on your mind to the point where you felt like your head was being emptied. What he'd do is he'd say, "What do you hear, Chris?" And then for a half hour, there'd be silence. And then you just talk and talk and talk. Everything you've heard, all the scuttlebutt you heard, everything that was on the talk shows that weekend, everything in the paper, everyone who was knocking his leadership or supporting him, everything the Republicans were up to. And this would go on. And then he'd say, "Now, anything else? Anything else?" And I'll tell you one thing. If you didn't tell him everything, he'd get angry because he expected me and some other people to tell him everything. And so he would never be cut off base. So he was a vacuum cleaner. Now, he doesn't have any rotary blades like the president to muffle his sound.
I like the story where you described the first time that you'd set up a meeting between President Reagan and Tip O'Neill, and it was in O'Neill's office. So Reagan comes in, and you're very self-conscious, and you say to him, Mr. President, this is the room where we plot against you."
Right.
And he said...
Well, I was trying to, in my own way, use an icebreaker there to sort of lighten the atmosphere, since it was the first time he'd come in his presidency. And it was, in fact, the room where the speaker had many of his meetings and many of his press conferences and still did right through the Reagan administration. I wanted to kid a little bit with the president. Now, the president, though, immediately came back and said, "Not after 6. The speaker says, in this town, we're all friends after 6. So he's, you know, the thing about meeting Reagan, I don't know if you've ever met him, but what staggers you about him is he isn't Ozzie Nelson. He isn't the regular guy next door. He's like the time I remember meeting Robert Redford one time and being staggered. These guys in the Hollywood business are very tough and very, very aware, very almost like animals in the forest. They're very alert to you, especially when they know you're the enemy.
Well, how much truth is that we're all friends after 6? Is there a shred of truth in that?
Well, I think the best part about being a professional politician or hardballer is that you're able to do what you can't do in student council meetings and amateur politics. You know, I remember in college we'd always get furious about student politics and screaming at each other and not talking to each other for months and years at a time. You know, the pros can argue fanatically on the House floor, and then on their way out of the chamber they can stop by the other side of the aisle, the other party's area, and say, "How are the kids? What are you doing this weekend?" And it reminds me of the way that they used to fight wars, you know, when the Americans won the big battle of Saratoga in New York, that one of the decisive battles of the Revolution. You know, the officer corps had dinner together afterwards on both sides. In other words, the defeated British had dinner with the victorious Americans. And, you know, it seems absurd, but the great thing about professional politics in a democracy is that you can be almost vicious in debate and in terms of fighting with each other, but you can still deal with each other as professionals afterwards. And I think that's a real proof of a hardballer, the ability to look the opponent right in the eye, chit-chat with them, and know that the next morning at 8 o'clock you're going to go at it again. And I think that's how democracies stay sane, actually. Because in Europe, that's not the way it is. From what I hear, in European democracies, the Socialist Party won't have anything to do with the Communist Party even to look at each other. There's no kidding back and forth. There's no casualness. There's no humanity to it. It's just totally ideological.
Tell me this. Do you think Tip O'Neill changed his style in any way when Reagan came into office?
Oh, yeah. He started doing television.
Uh-huh.
He had never done any television before, and he started to appear on television. He started to issue statements. He started to think in terms of speaking to 100 million people at a time. His whole career had been built on backroom, one-on-one, person-to-person, personal dealings. And I think he just changed from being a retailer to a wholesaler rather dramatically. It didn't happen overnight. And, you know, you have to say one of the reasons he became a political wholesaler or tried to take on Ronald Reagan is that he was forced to it because, as you recall, in 1980, the Republicans ran advertisements with an actor playing him, with the car that ran out of gas, is the metaphor. And, you know, I think he saw the writing on the wall that if he didn't appear on television, they would find somebody else to play the tackling dummy for them. I'll tell you, he went from 15 points in the Harris poll to 67 points in the Harris poll by the time he left office. And I think a good part of that is because people saw him as a gutsy guy they may not agree with. They may have thought he was too much of a big spender on certain things. But they liked him because he had guts.
Well,
and that's accurate, too, because I don't know how many mornings I'd come in the office, and I thought it was pretty disastrous in 81 and 82, and Ronald Reagan was the best thing since sliced bread, and what's this guy standing in his way for? And he'd still come to work. And sometimes the hardest thing in life is just to proceed, just to continue with a job that's brutal. I think a lot of people outside of politics understand that.
I think I've saved one of my most incisive questions for the end here.
All right.
Is there a difference between the haircuts and suits of the Democratic and the Republican aides?
How did you know that? Well, Terry, as a woman, I want to say something that may sound...
No, you're not a woman.
No, but, I'm going to say something to you as a woman.
I see.
I have noticed, and I think you can all test this at the two conventions this summer when you're watching them, you'll notice that Republican women have more structure to their hair than Democratic women.
Uh-huh.
In other words, they have more perms.
Let's talk about the men for a second. I'm talking about your experiences here. Your haircut, your suit. Could you have done that with the Republicans, or is there a difference?
Probably shorter hair, neater suits, more handkerchiefs in the pocket on the Republican side.
Uh-huh.
Democrats a little more loose. The suit may not match all the time. They may have the wrong color shoes on. Smarter, though.
Okay. Well, Christopher Matthews, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Christopher Matthews' new book is titled Hardball, How Politics is Played. And he's the Washington Bureau Chief of the San Francisco Examiner and a former chief spokesman for Congressman Tip O'Neill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Chris Mangus and Sean Slovo about their new film, A World Apart. The story is set in South Africa. It's based on the lives of Sean Slovo and her mother. Slovo wrote the screenplay. Mangus directed the film. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides, publishers of Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Parity Mukherjee writes about people like herself, new immigrants to America who are hip to the ways of the new country without abandoning their culture of birth. Coming up, we talk about Mukherjee's new book of short stories. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Earl Turpentine, a saxophonist who's made a living playing both jazz and rhythm and blues. And with television heading into summer reruns, TV critic David Bianculli says you have a second chance to catch the CBS crime series Wise Guy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. For the first time, a tobacco company will have to pay damages to a plaintiff who argued that cigarettes cause cancer. A jury in New Jersey today awarded $400,000 to the family of Rose Cipollone, a woman who smoked and died of lung cancer. But the jury cleared the cigarette makers Lorillard, Philip Morris, and the Liggett Group of conspiracy claims. Mubarak Awad, a Palestinian activist, was deported by the Israeli government today and put on a flight to New York. Awad headed a movement calling for nonviolent resistance to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The Palestinian uprising there was very much in evidence today, as NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
Today in the territories, especially the West Bank, there were widespread incidents, the scale of which has become more and more an everyday occurrence in the past week. There was a death today in the village of Abuwain, near the Arab city of Ramallah. A 43-year-old man was found dead with a single bullet wound to the forehead. Early witness reports said the army surrounded the village this morning, and the death occurred during a fierce confrontation between soldiers and demonstrators. The army says it is investigating. There were demonstrations in Nablus, Tulkarem, Hebron, Jenin, and Bethlehem, as well as in more than a half dozen refugee camps and villages. A high school has been closed down in Hebron, and there were demonstrations in at least six high schools in the West Bank that were broken up violently by soldiers, according to Palestinian sources. The army confirmed widespread incidents today and said that activities at West Bank high schools were closely watched by soldiers. The high schools have been reopened only a week after having been closed for 4 months. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
The Communist Party leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan differed sharply today on a regional dispute as strikes and demonstrations continued in the tense southern Soviet republics. Armenian Party Chief Surin Arutunyan promised a parliamentary vote in favor of uniting the Azerbaijani region of Nagorno-Karabakh with Armenia. But the Azerbaijani leader declared his republic would not cede the territory. Both leaders were speaking at mass demonstrations in the capitals of their republics. So far, efforts by Moscow to ease political tension in the republics have failed. More from the BBC's Jeremy Harris.
The somewhat fragmented picture emerging from the two southern republics, which remain resolutely barred to Western correspondents, suggests that little, if anything, has changed for the better during the 3.5 months since a rumbling territorial dispute erupted into violence at the end of February. The strike call in Armenia, which was reportedly endorsed by 500,000 people, and the response it seems to have attracted, indicate that Nagorno-Karabakh remains an issue with power to mobilize massive civil disobedience among Armenians. Confirmation from Azerbaijan that a local policeman has been killed by shots apparently fired at random by an Armenian is evidence that tension remains dangerously high. In Nagorno-Karabakh itself, a 3-week campaign of strikes and protests confirms that limited Kremlin concessions on education and culture in the region have failed to weaken the aspirations of the Armenian majority.
Jeremy Harris in Moscow. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev today met with a top Roman Catholic official in an effort to improve relations with the Vatican. Cardinal Agostino Casaroli, the Vatican Secretary of State, told reporters his meeting with Gorbachev was warm and friendly. Casaroli said statements by Soviet officials about allowing greater religious liberty are important, especially if the Soviet Union intends to allow believers to express their beliefs openly instead of merely allowing them internal freedom of conscience. Both sides said a papal visit and diplomatic relations are not imminent. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 2 points to close at 2099.40. Advances edged declines in trading of 125 million shares. The average price of a share gained 2 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says saxophonist Earl Turbinton is one of New Orleans' best-kept secrets. Turbinton is a lifelong resident of the city, and like many musicians there, he moves back and forth between jazz and rhythm and blues. He's toured with B.B. King and singer Jerry Butler, and he recorded with Joe Zawinul, who founded the group Weather Report. Kevin has a review of Turbinton's new album.
One of the oddest things about the singular city of New Orleans is that for all the great musicians who come from the place, there's never been much of a homegrown recording industry. Consequently, the great musicians who stay home remain only local heroes. It's one reason why players who move away in search of fame never complain of homesickness. Everyone in New Orleans knows who saxophonist Earl Turbinton is, but hardly anyone else does. Turbinton has a new album on the Rounder label, Brothers for Life, so-called because sibling Willie T wrote four of the tunes and plays piano and a little background synthesizer. Earl Turbinton plays mostly alto sax, but doubles on tenor and soprano. Before now, he's recorded only as a horn for hire. But unlike other commercial saxophonists who get a record date, he doesn't just show off a pretty sound. For the most part, Turbinton came to play. Here's his Fat Blues. Earl Turbinton hung out with John Coltrane for a few days in 1962, and that left an indelible stamp on his playing. But he tempers that Coltrane influence with a howling vocal quality of his own. Listen to him on his Nefer Doris. A bit of the mimic about Earl Turbinton. I've heard him do an astonishing impersonation of Ornette Coleman, and his recording of the calypso Kingston Town is very much in the style of Sonny Rollins. But then, New Orleans musicians have always been attracted to Caribbean rhythms. They help define the city's music. Turbinton's hometown rhythm section is bassist James Singleton and drummer David Lee. Thank you. Earl Turbinson's hardly the only saxophonist to borrow from Coltrane and Rollins, but he's one of the better ones. Because his tastes were formed when their music was new, he plays it with more conviction than most young musicians who treat older styles like they're the latest thing. In that sense, Turbinton's like the recently rediscovered bop alto saxophonist Frank Morgan. Also like Morgan, he's had the dubious advantage of nurturing his style for decades outside of the spotlight. Well, now that fans and critics finally realize how good Frank Morgan is, maybe there's hope for Earl Turbinton yet.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Earl Turbinton's new album, Brothers for Life, on the Rounder label. This is Fresh Air. New immigrants from third world countries who are trying to establish new lives for themselves in the United States and Canada are the subjects of Bharati Mukherjee's stories. Her new collection is called The Middleman and Other Stories. Like the characters in her books, Mukherjee shares two cultures. She was born and raised in Calcutta, but came to the United States 25 years ago. One story from her new anthology is called The Tenant. It's about an Indian woman living in America who's looking to meet a suitable Indian man. She turns to the personal ads of an Indian newspaper.
She goes onto the stack of India abroads, reads through matrimonial columns, and steals an issue to take home. Indian men want Indian brides. Married Indian men want Indian mistresses. All over America, handsome, tall, fair, engineers, doctors, data processors, the new pioneers, cry their eerie love calls. Maya runs a finger down the first column. Her fingertip, dark with newsprint, stops at random. Hello, hi, yes, you are the one I'm looking for. You are the new emancipated Indo-American woman. You have a zest for life. You are at ease in the USA, and yet your ethics are rooted in Indian tradition. The man of your dreams has come. Yours truly is handsome, ear-nose-throat specialist, well-settled in Connecticut. Age is 41, but never married. Physically fit, sportsmanly, and strong. I adore idealism, poetry, beauty. I abhor smugness, passivity, caste system. Write with recent photo. Better still, call.
You use the phrase new pioneers in that passage. That's a phrase you also use, I think, in another story. Is that a common phrase now for a new kind of settler in America?
For the kinds of people that I'm writing about, I want to see my characters, my immigrants, as heroes for having had the gumption to pull themselves out of one culture and dreamed of a better life in another and done something about it, as opposed to the characters in, say, earlier generations of expatriate writers who came unwillingly, perhaps as indentured laborers to Trinidad and so on, and who therefore seemed to think of themselves as permanent or perpetual expatriates, outsiders, and who complain.
Let's talk about why you moved to America. You first came to the United States to study at the University of Iowa. Why did you come?
To be a writer. My father, who passed away a year and a half ago, was a real patriarch and a rich man who also was a patron of the arts. And he had three daughters, no sons, so that he lavished opportunities and indulgences on us. And his idea was that I would write novels in the way that perhaps other accomplished women do embroidery or indulge in flower arrangements.
Did your parents expect that after you'd studied at the University of Iowa at the Writers' Workshop, that then you'd go back to India and write novels there and kind of pick up on your old life?
Absolutely. My parents expected me to do the right thing, which to them was learn to be a writer, and then go home and marry the man that they had picked out for me. But fate intervened. I met a writer who became my husband.
I want to quote something from your autobiographical novel, The Tiger's Daughter. And this is...
May I correct the tag autobiographical? I didn't know I was writing an autobiographical novel at the time. So while the character is not at all like me, I hope I'm smarter than Tara Banerjee, the lifestyle that I'm writing about is very much the lifestyle that I grew up in.
Well, let me read you this quote and see how it applies to you. This is about the woman who's now at a university in the United States. In school in India, she had not been permitted to think about sex. But now, realizing the girls identified her with the population explosion, the loop, vasectomies in railway stations, she blossomed into a bedside intellectual. I guess what I want to know there is, did you find yourself having to figure out how much experimenting you were going to do with new ethics and how much you were going to hold on to the ethics that you were brought up with?
I didn't spend much time thinking about what I was going to do. I just did. I'm an impulsive sort. What I did find out is that suddenly I was responsible for knowing about Indian population problems or about Indian poverty, that I had become a spokesperson for the whole country, if not the whole continent of Asia.
Well, that reminds me of something else, another issue that comes out in your new book of short stories. The predicament that someone is in when they've moved to the United States from another country and they've started to really understand the culture and become a part of it. And then a member of their family or a close friend comes from their home country and doesn't understand American culture at all. And the person who has been living in America has to explain it and kind of initiate them, and it's a very confusing enterprise. You have a wonderful section in your story called A Wife's Story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about a woman who's living in the United States. Her husband, who's a big businessman in India, comes to visit. And he, of course, wants to go on a tour to like see the sights around Manhattan. And so they go on a tour together. Can you read that section?
The bus is crowded, and we have to sit across the aisle from each other. The tour guide begins his patter on 46th. He looks like an actor, his hair bleached and blow-dried. Up close, he must look middle-aged, but from where I sit, his skin is smooth and his cheeks faintly red. Welcome to the Big Apple, folks. The guide uses a microphone. Big Apple, that's what we native Manhattan degenerates call our city. Today, we have guests from 15 foreign countries and 6 states from this U.S. of A. That makes the Tourist Bureau real happy. And let me assure you that while we may be the richest city and the richest country in the world, it's okay to tip your charming and talented attendant. He laughs. Then he swings his hip out into the aisle and sings a song. And it's mighty fancy on old Delancey Street, you know. My husband looks irritable. The guide is, as expected, a good singer. The bloody man should be giving us histories of buildings we are passing, no? I pat his hand. The mood passes. He cranes his neck. Our window seats have both gone to Japanese. It's the tour of his life. Next to this, the quick business trips to Manchester and Glasgow pale. And tell me what street compares to Mott Street in July. The guide wants applause. He manages a derisive laugh from the Americans up front. He's working the aisles now. I could have been somebody, right? I could have been a star. Two or three of us smile, those of us who recognize the parody. He catches my smile. The sun is on his harsh, bleached hair. Right, Your Highness? Look, we got a Maharini with us. Couldn't I have been a star? Right, I say, my voice coming out a squeal. I've been trained to adapt. What else can I say?
I really love that passage. When you started writing, after you came to the United States to learn more about writing, but when you started to write, were you not sure which culture you should be writing about, what the location of your story should be?
Not which culture I should be writing about, but the validity of one's material. I think the harshest legacy of post-colonialism is lack of self-confidence and feeling that your experiences, your cultural experiences, are somehow not worthwhile. I realize that one can, that a good writer makes interesting and makes important the alien material. And so, you know, I have tried to do that with my characters and my version of America.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Bharati Mukherjee's new book, The Middleman and Other Stories, is published by Grove Press. Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's up?
Well, more from the Soviet Union on the Armenian-Azerbaijani dispute. It appears that the leaders of the communist parties in those two neighboring republics in the south of the Soviet Union are at odds over what should be done. Also, we have an interview with James LeMoyne, the New York Times correspondent in Central America, about torture in Honduras, the role the CIA had in training Hondurans to perform psychological torture, and to talk with a psychiatrist from Denmark whose project is treating the victims of torture with psychotherapy.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The CBS crime series Wise Guy premiered last fall, was pulled off the air in November, reappeared in January, and finished its season this spring. Wednesday night, Wise Guy is back in reruns. Television critic David Bianculli explains the logic.
It was about this time, 3 years ago, that NBC's Miami Vice began to take off. Most viewers had skipped it during the regular season and watched Dallas instead. But in the summer, when competition was weak, Miami Vice reruns were as good as new. By the time fresh episodes started in the fall, it was a top 10 hit. Now, I'm not predicting the same happy ending for Wise Guy, but for several reasons, its return is worth mentioning and worth getting excited about. At first glance, it looks like just another cop show. Ken Wall plays Vinny Terranova, an organized crime agent whose cover is so deep that he's sent to prison for 18 months. When he comes out, his only links with the force are his boss Frank, played by Jonathan Banks, and his phone contact, a guy named Lifeguard. He's played by Jim Burns, who, like his character, works from a wheelchair. Vinny's assignment is to befriend a hood named Sonny Steelgrave, who's on a fast track as the J.R. Ewing of organized crime. Steelgrave is played by Ray Sharkey, who starred in The Idolmaker, and Sharkey has a blast making his character scared and scary at the same time. As Sonny gets more powerful, so does Sharkey's performance.
I feel like a side of beef. Everybody's trying to hack off their favorite cut. Patrice in New York, Mahoney down in Philly. I got that snake sitting in the office where my brother used to be. I'm fighting for my life here.
Wise Guy, like Crime Story, is a serialized cop show, which means that stories continue from one episode to the next. The gimmick works just as well for cops and robbers as it does for primetime soaps. When the good guys don't have to triumph at the end of each episode, the villains and the writers can have a lot more fun. It's no accident that the soap's biggest draws are the schemers, not the dreamers. J.R. of Dallas, Alexis of Dynasty, Abby of Knott's Landing. Sonny Steelgrave of Wise Guy is right up there. He grows to love Vinny and occasionally trust him, but there are times, lots of times, where Vinny's loyalty and life are put on the line.
You look nervous, Vincent.
Yeah, all right, I'm a little nervous. Harry told me you get these calls in the middle of the night means one of two things. Either getting a promotion or a hollow point in the head.
It's the uncertainty of it all that makes those little hairs stand up in the back of your neck.
It takes half a season for Sonny's story to come to an end. And if things go according to schedule, that'll lead right into a new season of Wise Guy episodes. It's a ride worth taking. The guest stars are great, even in the small roles, and Jonathan Banks is the best and most sarcastic TV boss since Lou Grant. One warning, Ken Wall, the alleged star of the show, is its weakest link. It hardly matters, though. Executive producer Stephen J. Cannell, who spent the last few years doing toss-away TV like The A-Team, has come up with his best show since 10 Speed and Brown Shoe and The Rockford Files. It gets better as it goes along. It's obvious that the script's kicked up a few notches once the writers saw what Sharkey could do. But like a roller coaster, you can take the slow parts because you know the thrills are just down the track. Besides, during the summer, how many thrills do you expect from TV?
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Sylvia Sims, a singer who learned a lot from her friends, Fats Waller, Billie Holiday, and Frank Sinatra. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile the Flamingos, the doo-wop group that had the hit of I Only Have Eyes for You. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will mark Flag Day by saying the Pledge of Allegiance, singing the national anthem, and seeing how much sense they make. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.